You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio. Days Soulmate is brought to you by 90 Days Solutions.
Welcome to 90 Days Soulmate with Lisette
and Jim.
Today we're going back to a subject we talked about last week, which has to do with learning, and it has to do with acquiring skills. We talked about nature versus nurture and how some things that are natural in the DNA
versus you working hard and development.
Work hard and develop. And we brought up a subject of a gentleman who trained three of his daughters in chess until they became all grandmasters of chess, fantastic chess players. We'll go back to that to understand that a little bit. And then we've got some really interesting things. Today's subject we will be talking about is how to master anything.
Sounds interesting. You are a master in something?
I don't know. I'm a master in all things. And what do they call that? A jack of all trades, master of none. But what we're here to tell you is that you can be maybe master of many trades. We have so many hours in the day, so many things that we can do. Our brain is so special. Our bodies are so incredible that we can learn, whether it's a sport, whether it's an activity, physical, karate, riding a bicycle, whatever.
Cooking. Yeah, master
eating,
chef.
Eating.
And that you are expert.
I'm a master in eating.
Yeah.
I'm a master in procrastination, too, sometimes.
Yeah,
right?
I approve.
I work hard on procrastinating. But in how to master anything, we wanted to take a look at the story of the three young ladies who were taught chess, plus other things. And this came up because a conversation that I was having with a younger person about filmmaking. And they were getting a script from a friend, and they were trying to determine, is this script good? Is it not good? And not having a real background in film other than being around people who do a little bit of filming.
Practice.
I read the script, and I had to ask myself this question, and I said this to the person who asked me the question. I said, is the person who wrote the script, are they a genius? Were they born like just super smart? They excelled in everything they did. They just are vastly superior in intellect. Or have they, where did they study? Where did they take their courses? Where did they get information? Where did they get their techniques? Where did they get their writing style? Who have they read? What authors? How many books? The questions are, you either have to be born a genius and naturally roll into something. And I think Quentin Tarantino was being interviewed. At the age of 26, he made a film. And I think, I don't remember which TV show he was on, but he was being interviewed, and they interviewed him about making his first film, which turned out to be, as he said, I think, a total flop. It was terrible. It was 3 years. 3 years of spending money, spending time, hiring actors, getting people to do the filming. He was part of it. He was directing. He was putting this movie together, and he put it together for 3 years, and it was terrible, he says. But what he said was, I spent 3 years learning everything I needed to know, what needed to be done, what didn't need to be done, what was good, what wasn't good. And that was part of learning, the learning experience. But it was a very high level learning experience. And he turns out to be, I think, a genius when it comes to filmmaking. If he's a genius when it comes to filmmaking, how many people out there want to become filmmakers, but they don't have his genius? So they need to take another method, another way of getting there. And a lot of that is, yes, it is actual doing the filmmaking, but it's learning, learning what you need to know to be a writer, to be a producer, yeah. to film technique, editing techniques. There is so much to master. So how to master anything is our subject.
It's dedication, it's hours of work. Yeah.
Lots of hours of work. So the review that we wanted to do of the chess experiment. You remember this, Lizette?
Yes.
Laszlo Polgár. He believed that geniuses are made and not born. So he didn't believe in the Quentin Tarantino method of becoming a genius film producer. He believed that you could take anybody and they could become a genius film producer. Or in this case, he sought to prove that any healthy child, if taught early and intensively, can be brought up to be exceptionally successful in any field. How many of us have had that opportunity at a young age to be trained, tutored, mentored, and put through thousands of hours of training? So he married a fellow teacher who shared his views, and together they had three daughters. Chess would be an objective measure of the success of his theory. Could he train them to become immensely successful in chess? So, do you remember what happened on this?
Yes, that's past show we're talking about that.
We did. So, chess had been considered a male-dominated trait. So the result of all this is that women were thought to be unable to compete by the chess establishment. Women are unable to achieve the results similar in fields. Actually, his result was he proved by his experiment that women were able in all fields of intellectual activities to meet and exceed the results and achievements of men. Chess was an intellectual activity that was unbiased in the success, meaning it wasn't like art.
Okay.
Okay. So he had elite coaches, and the results were the three children. Susan, the eldest, became the first grandmaster of the sport. The second child became an international master, and the third, who was the most successful, who was also the youngest, beat one of the top male players at the time, especially a male player who was saying that, oh, female players just aren't as good. They can't compete. And he was beaten by her.
Good.
Go Judith. Good work. But the point of this was intense study, practice, training in an intellectual pursuit can put you at the top of a field, but it takes work and dedication.
Yeah.
10,000 hours is what they attributed the amount of time that was given to how much they spent in this training of becoming these phenomenal chess players.
Mm-hmm.
So what is 10,000 hours?
It's 5 years, 3 years.
Let's just think about this. 3 hours a day, mm-hmm. every day of a year. If you do something for 3 hours a day, every day of the year, that's 1,000 hours in 1 year. That's 3 hours a day. 3 hours a day every day for 365 days is, am I doing this correctly? 1,000 hours. To hit 10,000 hours, that's 10 years of 3-hour-a-day practice.
Yeah. So maybe you have to practice 8 hours per day.
It is a lot.
Yeah.
And so when you talk about that, you know, we go to school and we think we've learned something. Oh, I'm going to get a college education, then I'm going to be successful. College education may be the start of success for somebody. A technical education may be the start for somebody. Working on the job may be the start for somebody. But once you've been doing something for 6 months, you're not an expert in what you're doing.
Yeah.
There's a lot more, if you are really interested in what you're doing and becoming an expert, there's a lot you can learn to put in that time to become an expert. Let's see what else we have here. So I wanted to get to the second part.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember our trip to California?
Sure, it was wonderful.
Where did we go?
Go to the Francis Coppola winery.
We went to Coppola.
Yeah.
We also went to his boutique winery mm-hmm. called Inglenook. Mm-hmm. Inglenook is, I guess, another winery that they had purchased. I believe there's a Coppola house way in the back beyond the vineyards when we took a tour. Mm-hmm. Don't know if they actually go there, visit there, if anyone's there ever. But while we were there, we got to have a wine tasting in a private room, which was Francis Ford Coppola's library.
Yeah.
And it blew my mind.
Yeah, beautiful, big, and a lot of interesting books
on every subject. I mean, from history to science.
And also book like that. Yeah.
Giant books.
I think part of it is
show, but if you see the books in there from Homer and from Shakespeare and Kipling and Dickens and people we don't even know. And we'll go over some of these, is that we were so amazed by the books that were in there. The commercial that we're going to play, or we may have played already, show us in the library, show some of the books in the library, the size of it, the beauty of it. And thinking about this 10,000-hour
training.
Mm-hmm. If you were to read these books of famous authors, of very world-impacting themes, some of its history, some of its revolution, some of its evolution.
And also from different countries, because I see the different countries.
Yeah, one of the things, and we'll go over this in a little bit, but one was, where is it here? Arabian poetry. I found that very interesting. There's also one that was the Story of Modern Science, which was a collection of books on different science sections, such as Radio Mastery of the Ether.
Wow.
So I don't know how old the book is. It could be just when Marconi first did it. You know, it could be a Marconi production. Man and the Magic of Medicine. Wonder Working by Machinery. I like this one. Conjuring with Plants. Juggling with Animal Life. And maybe that was interbreeding and controlling animal life. Or maybe it was Steve Martin where he was juggling cats. I'm not sure. Charting the Universe. Exploring the Atom. So this is just one of the collections. Now, this is a science-focused collection, which could have been 50 years old.
Yeah.
Could be a lot older. But it was the modern thought of science at the time in a wide array of subjects. Mastery of his profession, he thought was accomplished through a very deep understanding of many subjects, styles of writing, types of writing. And part of this is, hey, maybe I'll come across a story that I want to adapt into a motion picture.
Yeah.
And then Francis Ford Coppola became the writer, director, and sometimes even producer of those movies. And the reason we talk about him is he's a very phenomenal figure. Had a vast, deep impact in what we saw growing up. It was when we were tiny kids, probably even before you were born, some of these movies.
I don't know that.
We'll do a little bit of a history of his life in a moment here. When we come back to 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette.
Jim.
We're here at Inglenook at Francis Ford Coppola's new winery. Well, they've had it for a few years, but this is his library. Books that he has read over the years that have accumulated in his knowledge and his ability to come up with amazing storylines, beautiful video edits, creativity of films unlike anyone else. Let's take a look at one of the books in his library. Here we have 90 Day Soulmate, How to Find Your Perfect Match in 90 Days by Lizette Guevara and James Gulmick, actually Jim Gulmick. Well, if it's good enough for Francis Ford Coppola, it's good enough for you.
Welcome back to 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette.
And Jim.
Today we're talking about learning how to master anything.
Mastering karate.
Master in tennis, master in movie making. We have been talking about Francis Ford Coppola and the specific things that we think he had done in order to become as prominent and as well known in what he has done as anybody. It doesn't come like he didn't have, it's not like he did not have failures, because not everything he did turned out good, but he tried. He tried lots of different things, lots of different directions. And let's go a little bit through his life. What's amazing, I think amazing, is that he was born in 1939, and his life, the movies he's made, what he's directed, have covered everything from the early 60s or mid-60s through late into the 2000s. So he has 50, 60 years of movie making under his wing. He has been involved in directing, writing, producing such epics as The Godfather, The Conversation, and Apocalypse Now. Some of these movies had amazing videography, dialogue, but some of the things that he's been involved with, the only way he could write and direct is to actually understand in detail what was going on at the time. That means if it had to do with Vietnam, if it had to do with a war, if it had to do with a car, he had to understand the mechanisms, the mechanics, the science, the countries that were involved and why they were arguing with each other if it was a war.
Yeah.
That it wasn't just make a movie.
Yeah, they had to understand culture, knowledge of the character in the movies, and this is take a time.
It does. And the last thing I wanted to hit on this page was that what he was known for was back in the 70s, he attempted to create an alternative to Hollywood system of film production and distribution, which I believe also incorporated, he was thinking of being able to beam up the movies to satellites and have the satellites beam movies directly down to consumers, bypassing the typical way movies were distributed. That he had these ideas that weren't far-fetched. They may not have been successful, but they were based upon his knowledge of a vast array of subjects. Let's see. Going to the next one now. Boom. So how did he grow up? So early on in his life, Francis Ford Coppola's father was a composer himself, played the flute in a number of orchestras, wasn't like that successful in this field. He wasn't a big, he didn't have a lot to offer Francis Ford Coppola in an effort for Francis Ford Coppola to become a director, that there may have been a tendency for the father and the family to be involved in the arts because they were involved in music, but the film thing was Francis Ford Coppola's. So grew up in Queens and in Great Neck on Long Island. Some of the other stuff we'll just talk about is at the age of 9, because he was suffering from polio and bedridden and couldn't move around, he started putting together puppet shows.
Oh.
Puppet shows to keep him interested, give him something to do. So what do? He was creative. That was an early sign at the age of 9 that he was creative, creating these puppet shows with different characters interacting with each other. So now here you are directing.
Yeah, completely.
Directing
movies.
Puppet.
Yeah.
He also started making 8mm films. So, you know, at a young age, you know, you're talking about 9 years old, 10 years old, 8mm films. This is also the technology at this time. An 8mm film camera would not have been inexpensive. But we're talking about, I guess, if he was born in 1939. This is a little bit interesting because that would have been 9 years old. That would have been 1948. So I'm not sure.
What kind of technology there was.
Yeah,
at this time, yeah.
He was doing sketches.
Also, you see in the museum how so many, in the 90s, technologies.
Yeah.
So they put some light and then moving around some pictures, try to project the wall.
Yes.
Yeah, so you see how he go deep to progress of technology.
And he had a lot of, in the museum area, they had a lot of those early things of the film era, which I'm guessing was something he was attracted to too, is how these things work. The still pictures, where you put 24 pictures in 1 second, and suddenly it stops action. Yeah. It becomes a moving thing, and these were. What are those? The spinning circles that had the little slits, and you could see the animals running around. Mm-hmm. I know this is a hard explanation, but if you go there to Inglenook, there's a nice museum there that shows some of these items. Mm-hmm. He did end up, and this is where we start talking about education of people, whether it's you, whether it's us, whether it's anyone, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a college education, but it should be something that if you're interested in something, you know, we have people that we know that go to welding school and they come back with a profound difference in how they are able to do something, and they continue on with a profession and they learn more, they study more, they watch videos, they go to more classes, they work with different materials, they want to learn how to work with steel and now aluminum and now stainless steel and, you know, different techniques, and that you start becoming an expert in whatever you do, mm-hmm. which as an expert in whatever you do, it's hopefully is your passion or becomes a passion. When you become good at something, you can start to become passionate about it. You can, you know, I think part of this neuroplasticity mm-hmm. is that as you get involved in researching a subject, it becomes part of you. And now your brain actually wants to know more. It can push you to being passionate.
Yeah. Right? So when you prepare this material, I see your passion searching topic because to be involved in the topic.
And we learn. Yeah. We learn as we share what we're finding with our audience, ourselves.
It's our own practice.
It's good. So we are doing exactly what we're suggesting is whatever you find interesting to you, that you learn more about, you become more knowledgeable in, you can then talk more knowledgeably about, and you become more passionate about it.
And your brain feels better.
Oh, it does. So again, he got a Bachelor of Arts in drama from Hofstra University. But the other thing that he did was he got a master degree of fine arts from the University of California in Los Angeles in the art of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. So, bachelor and master's in drama and filmmaking, but there's more. What do you mean there's more? What do you mean, Jim, there's more? So, while all this is going on, while he's studying, he's not only studying, but he's doing. He's actually working. He worked for a low-budget film producer-director, and he was acting as a second-unit photographer and director, which means he's not doing the primary filming. He's doing alternative shots. He's doing, I call it B-roll or other stuff. He's not involved with the main director, but he works for the main director.
Okay.
And so he was doing that. So he had a responsible role, but it was a lesser role for a low-budget producer. He wrote dialogue and dubbed into his re-edited versions of a pair of Russian-made films, which when he wrote the dialogue and dubbed them, there are two movies out there from 1962 called The Magic Voyage of Sinbad and Battle Beyond the Sun, which now I want to see. Before we were born, he made two movies which were Russian films that he overdid this dialogue and dubbed. And so he created American versions of these two, or English-speaking versions of these two films. Now I want to see them. He then wrote his first movie and directed it called Dementia 13 in 1963. And then directed a movie called You're a Big Boy Now in 1966, which was his master's thesis. So all these things that he was doing.
It's also part of the career and part of the how he like and the effort and hours.
A lot of effort. Yeah, so the thing that I thought was interesting is taking the Russian-made films. You know, you take the Russian-made films, you write dialogue in English, you dub it in, re-edit it, and create a new movie. And now
what happened? The copyright.
It's a Russian-made film. Who knows?
Maybe he changed the topic because he don't understand Russian. Yeah.
That's how we got Moby Dick. No, that's not how we got Moby Dick. But while all this is going on, we want to talk. We'll talk about that library in a minute here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we actually will talk about the library. We stumbled into that library, and when we did, and by the way, when we were at break, you probably saw that commercial where we're talking from the library and showing the pictures of the library, how beautiful it is, how immense it is, how large it is, the quantity of books, the types of books.
Okay, so you wanna share some titles?
Sure. Well, what we'll do is we'll share this here, which is some of the titles. Actually, some of the authors in there, and we can talk a little bit about who these people are. So, Washington Irving, well known for a lot of things, well known for a George Washington biography, a multi volume set of George Washington's life. He published it in multiple volumes over a 4-year period. It included his military exploits. This is George Washington, life as president, and life as just a normal person, his personal life. He created a highly interesting, readable set of biography that many, I'll just say, the average person could read and gain a knowledge of George Washington. What he did was, George Washington was so well known as this president, you know, the father of the country, the first president, and he was held to such high esteem that what Washington Irving was able to do was make him presentable into an everyday type of character where people understood him more. Okay. So they removed him from, and how this was written was, removed him from a demigod position in people's view and related on a normal level. So this was one of the books, the multi-volume book by Washington Irving on George Washington was part of the collection. He's also known for, Washington Irving is well known for Rip Van Winkle, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and then The History of Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus, which some people say wasn't an entirely accurate view of Christopher Columbus. But it's just a vast array. Just one author has all this history behind him. Victor Hugo wrote the movie, actually not the movie, but wrote the story.
The Los Miserables.
I have Lizette say that because I have a hard time with that because it's so many syllables.
Los Miserables.
Okay. Les Miserables.
Les Miserables.
All right. So we have Shakespeare. Just a few of the, he had all of Shakespeare's collection, giant books of Shakespeare. He had A Midsummer Night's Dream, Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, Taming of the Shrew, just to name a few of Shakespearean classics, but all of them were there. I have no reason to doubt that Francis Ford Coppola did not read all of them.
Yeah.
And one of the things is, you read these and get ideas, as we talked about earlier, actually we're going to talk about it in a little bit, but having multiple subjects on all different
topics
yeah. by different authors with different writing styles, different points of view, different time periods, allows you to connect vast sums of knowledge in ways that make sense to you. So if you only, and this is something we'll talk about in our third segment, but if you only focus on, say, one author, you only understand their style, you either find their style and copy their style
or influence by
their style.
Yeah, so you lose the capacity to see other stuff.
But when you are reading on a wide array of subjects by all different authors, different times, different languages, you now have, you find what's common to you based upon your own biases and your own preferences. You find what you feel fits you. And then you're able to have all the, at your fingertips, You have access to all this information, all these thoughts, all these ideas that just come out of you the way you would present them. We're going to actually talk about that, as we said, in our third segment. Other authors. Let's go to Charles Dickens, who is well known for A Christmas Carol. We see that almost every year. David Copperfield, A Tale of Two Cities. Great Expectations. We look at Arabian poetry, so poetry from Arabia. The Story of Modern Science, which we talked about before, which is radio, Mastery of the Ether, Man and the Magic of Medicine, Wonder Working by Machinery. By the way, there are other books in here that I did not list because the topics were, I don't want to say off color. They at the time, they were probably very prevalent types of subjects to be studied and read and written about. But today you look back and you go, oh my, these subjects are probably not something that you want to be known for in your reading list. On the other hand, you might want to read about them so you know what people are thinking that you disagree with. So it could be taken either way. Rudyard Kipling's work, such as The Jungle Book, which everyone knows The Jungle Book.
Yeah.
The Second Jungle Book, I guess that came after the first one. Seven Seas, Captain Courageous, Kim, Actions and Reactions. And we have a couple more books to talk about when we come back after this break from 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette
and Tim.
We're here at Inglenook at Francis Ford Coppola's new winery. Well, they've had it for a few years, but this is his library, books that he has read over the years that have accumulated in his knowledge and his ability to come up with amazing storylines, beautiful video edits, creativity of films unlike anyone else. Let's take a look at one of the books in his library. Here we have 90 Day Soulmate, How to Find Your Perfect Match in 90 Days by Lizette Guevara and James Gulmick, actually Jim Gulmick. Well, if it's good enough for Francis Ford Coppola, it's good enough for you.
Welcome back to 90 Day Soulmate with Lizette.
And Jim.
Today we're talking about how to master anything. We've really pushed deep into Francis Ford Coppola for a reason. A lot of people believe he's a master of a director, of a writer, of a filmmaker. And what we wanted to do is model this show kind of after what he did and how he accomplished it. One is he went to school, he learned. Bachelor and master's, whole set of books, lots of learning in different subjects, as well as actually hands-on experience making movies successfully and unsuccessfully to learn. But everything from the hard work that we said that the chess experiment showed to probably a little bit of genius, but who knows, because you know his parents weren't in the industry, they weren't well known. There wasn't a lot of influence, and that it was all kind of self-taught as he went and followed his passion from a young age of 9. What we want to do, though, is move into, if I can get to the subject here, our third and final segment of the show, which relates directly to you and us. And it
finally.
Is. It is. Rapid learning. How do we take 10,000 hours of learning and rapidly do it in 1 week?
Which is the Matrix. You remember the movies?
The Matrix. We just plug in. We get canoe reads.
Yeah.
And we just plug in to the Matrix.
That's it.
Would you like, what is your thought? Okay. Oh, we need to get off that. Okay. So, Rapid Learning, The Science of Rapid Skill Acquisition. It's a book by Peter Hollins. We're going to summarize it a little bit, put our own twist, our own take on it, but it was a very good book. It starts off with what is learning, anyway. What is learning? It's the ability to change your life and circumstances. We talk about that 90 Day Soulmate, for those who are out of a relationship, looking to get into a relationship or find their soulmate, that 90 Day Soulmate offers a step in learning, right? Skill acquisition, where you can learn certain techniques that maybe you haven't done in the past. Assess your past relationships, your past family upbringing, what your preferences are, and really kind of focus on yourself and what you're looking for in a relationship before you
engage with somebody.
Yeah.
Do first.
Please. We've engaged with the wrong person. No. You know, if you keep meeting the same person, you got to stop going to the same place and stop looking for the same person. And you got to understand that, though, is that people are different, but in order to be different, you yourself have to become different. To find different people, you have to become different. So it's changing your circumstances is what this is all about. So why do you want to learn? Question is, do you want to do it for happiness? You know, I'm unhappy. I want to learn how. I don't want to be as anxious as I am. I want to be able to overcome anxiety. I want to take stress out of my life. Finances. I want to increase my income. Life purpose. Because my life purpose is this, and I need to know more about it so I can actually do this. Or to cope with circumstances.
And also survive, because if you have more knowledge, you can handle better situation.
And that would be the coping with circumstances, survive, situations, to understand, to learn more about it. Because we have so little education, right? In dealing with situations, with dealing with life. We have 12 years, 13 years of going to school to learn all these subjects, but very few of them are
about life
and how to talk to someone. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So that is one, is why do you want to learn? There are four stages that are represented in this book, but I've heard elsewhere as well on learning. And this is where you are. The four stages of competency would be unconscious incompetence. Unconscious incompetence. When you don't know, you don't know. So some people think they really are good at something because they don't know that they're not,
mm-hmm.
right? They don't have a perspective of, oh my gosh, I'm wrong. You know, like they say something over and over again and they don't know they're wrong, so they believe they're right. So unconsciously incompetence, meaning you have no idea you're incompetent. I have no idea, I don't know.
And also the good example is, I had this question last week with one customer about Excel. So he said, no, I know Excel because I have the sheet, I put some numbers, and Excel is huge.
No.
You can do program, you can do macros, you can do a lot of stuff that we don't know. So you believe, it's unconscious, you believe, oh yes, I know Excel. You really don't know.
I know that I can put a list together and add numbers.
That's it.
But I didn't know that I could actually bring up drawings and pictures and configure things in it. I didn't know that I could do vertical lookups, horizontal lookups. I didn't know I could do automatically dating things, putting time in there, doing a subtraction of one time to another. That the more you start knowing about something, you can suddenly be overwhelmed with how much you don't know. And now you've moved into, I now consciously am incompetent. Now I know what I need to know about Excel, right?
Mm-hmm.
In order to excel, I need to learn this about Excel. But in any subject, what do I need to know? Now, once you know what you need to know, you start, quote, acquiring that, right? You start learning about it. But in order to apply what you're learning, you have to make an effort to apply. And that's what we call the conscious competence stage. You can do it. You are now competent, but it takes a lot of effort. You may have to pull a book out. You may have to go to this chapter in the book and look up something again. You may have to look up numbers. You may have to look up a chart. You
have to make a note. You have to review your notes. You have to make a reflection about your notes. So
there's a lot of consciously you're doing things in order to be competent. You know, if I'm driving, first thing I need to do is put my foot on the brake. I need to turn this way, hands on 10 and 2 on the steering wheel. Consciously, you do everything correctly in order to do it competently. It's like, say, karate, right? So you learn a kata in karate, and you learn the kata, but you're consciously having to work through it. At some point, you may train your body and your mind to be so tightly competent that you can just do the kata without thinking about the kata.
Yeah.
So that's like self-defense without thinking, without mind. And then finally, that gets us to that last part. When you're able to do it without thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, I play tennis. I know, well, I don't play tennis. Let's pretend I play tennis. Mm-hmm. That I know when I do a backhand stroke, I need to stand a certain way. I need to come over the ball. I need to move my arm back because my trainer taught me to do this. And so every time I have a backhand, I consciously think, 1, 2, 3, 4. And I do these steps that I was taught. Now I start playing tennis and I do it every day. You know, I do my 10,000 hours of tennis and now I'm just playing tennis. I'm not thinking, it's programmed in. Now that's a physical activity. Yeah. Is that the same thing done mentally?
Yes, I guess that you have some work that you do. And I interviewed one guy last week and he have 36 years doing in the technical department to produce some kind of metal piece with gold and stuff. So he say, how you do that? And he said, he know the procedure in the mind. He know has to read and he stop because 35 years doing this is expert.
Now knows how, is an expert, is a master. So we were talking just before the show about the multiplication table. Mm-hmm. Is it better to have the multiplication table memorized or to know how to multiply?
That is my question for you.
I have two answers to that. One is, the answer is both.
Yeah.
You need to know both. And the reason you need to know both is this, is I need to know how to multiply in order to check what I know about the multiplication table. But I need to know the multiplication table in my head so I can rapidly do something. That if I know that 5 times 7 is 35, and I don't have to think about it, it's 5 times 7 is 35, 9 times 5 is 45, that these are, you know, 12 times 12 is 144. These are things that you just know, but it took you a hard amount of effort to memorize it when you're in third grade.
Yeah.
But if you don't know how to multiply, you don't know why 12 times 12 is 144, that if you are given 12 times 33 and you don't know how to multiply, well, what do? Mm-hmm. I don't know how to do it. Or if for some reason I think 12 times 12 is 143 and I am doing something and it comes out wrong and I've somehow my memory's messed up, I have to be able to do it. So the memorization short circuits your thought process to save you time. It's an efficient way of doing something.
It's more quickly answered.
Yeah. It is. So what else do we have? So we have, what are tips? What are tips? Tips for learning, types of learning. So how do we break this down? Types of learning. Four types of learning are brought up in the book. Deliberate learning. So drilling on specific thing in depth, like we just talked about, multiplication table. You just work on it, work on it, work on it. You memorize it. You know what you have to learn. You memorize it. Or you want to learn the alphabet and how to say it in a different language. You work on it specifically. It's deliberate. You're working on it. In tennis, I work on my forehand. I have a trainer showing me how to do it. I work on that one thing over and over deliberately. No. I want to work on my relationship. I get out the book. I go to page, whatever the page would be. Let's find a page in here. Any page. And there's a page right there. Page 36. I start filling out the table of elements of attraction, elements of conflict, my reflection on this relationship, what I would like to do differently in the future. I'm deliberately working on it. I now have worked on it. The interleaved type of learning is breaking up learning into smaller subjects. So it would be like how we go to school when we're a kid. We go to English class, then we go to math class, then history, then science, art, gym, that we break it up into small segments. The reason for that, and we talked about this, is like, if you went to the gym to work out and all you did were curls, at some point your muscle just can't do anything more. But if you start doing...
You lose Popeye.
But if you start doing leg press, now you can work on your leg. And now your legs get tired, you can work on your back, and your back gets tired. Think of it the same way when you work on a subject. Your brain has different areas that work on different things. You have the math side of your brain, the art side of your brain, the English side of your brain. You have these areas that focus on these certain skills. Once you start thinking about math, and it's hard, and you're working at it, you start pushing your brain to grow through neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. Your brain is growing just like that muscle, but at some point you've worked so hard, you just can't go any further. You make no more progress by pushing any further with math. So now you go to English class and you start working in English class and you start, what is it called? You start moving to that section of your brain, which now does the same thing. The more you work in English and words and learning language and how to spell, that's a portion of your brain. But at some point, it's overloaded. So then you go outside and you run around for a little while, right? So it's gym class. Then you come back in, and it's science. So science has a little bit of math in it, has some English in it, but it might be memorization of different chemical reactions. So that's another area of your brain that you're working on. So neuroplasticity and interleaved learning, breaking things up into small blocks, is much more effective in higher skill acquisition than by trying to focus on one thing too much. Because at some point, you're done. Spaced repetition. What does that mean?
Spaced repetition. Yeah. So you have to repeat.
Over time.
Over time, the topic that you want to learn.
So the question is, if I want to spend 5 hours, is it more impactful in my learning to spend 5 hours on one day of learning or 1 hour for 5 days?
1 hour for 5 days.
Right. So 1 hour per 5 days is better for you than 1 day of 5 hours. 1 day of 5 hours, you get to a point where you've burned out. It's like, again, you're doing curls. I can do curls for 5 hours today, or I can go to the gym 5 days this week for an hour. Overall, it's better for me to break it up and do a little bit, allow myself to recover, build, and then go back again. What the analogy, the metaphor, the simile, whatever it's called. My body is like my brain. If I don't want to do it with my body because it doesn't make sense, we shouldn't do that to our brain. Problem based. You were asking this question.
Okay.
So you work on a problem to solve Y in order to learn X. We do that in school a lot. We memorize an equation. But then when we get to the test, they have you find something. And then you got to figure out what equation to use. And then you have to figure out, did I do it correctly? And then you learn actually more than the memorization of the equation. You learn, like, you know, okay, when I throw something up, it goes this far and it comes down. I can memorize the equation. But now when I work it out and work it out in real life, maybe I also do an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can...
So for acceleration versus, you know...
And that you show that in real life, the measurements you do of what you just did work out. And so now I've proven my calculation. I now understand when you throw a ball up, it starts slowing down and then it comes downward. And when it comes down, it accelerates down.
Mm-hmm.
And I did my calculation and now I actually understand what they mean. The interesting thing, and this is the integration, is that... I am in physics, I learn about that. I'm in calculus, and I learn about the relationship between velocity and acceleration and distance, because those are all equations that are interrelated to each other, and I learn that in math class, but then I'm actually doing experiments in science class that are related.
It's the same what we did with the book, because we know our psychology, we're engineering, but we apply engineering in the relationship.
We applied engineering in relationship, but what was also interesting is that after writing the book,
mm-hmm.
we went to learn about psychology because we were so interested in it and went back to school for industrial and organizational psychology. Why? Because we wanted to become master of something. How to master anything? Be interested in it. Yeah. Number one, be interested in it. Why are you interested in it? Two, determine how you want to study. Three, don't just fix yourself on one way of learning. So what that means is you should be looking at multiple areas. If I want to learn more about relationships, don't just learn about relationships from one author. Mm-hmm. Read different books, read different subjects, find things you're interested in. Allow you to learn a lot of stuff and then figure out from your own point of view, your own bias, how that fits and relates to you, so you can then become an unconsciously competent person in whatever subject you'd like to be.
So this is the reason that you marry so many times, is practice.
I practice. I want to become unconsciously competent in marriage.
There you go.
Hoping you have a wonderful day, rest of your week, whatever time of it is.
And 90 Days Soulmate.
And 90 Days Soulmate. Thanks for watching. Have a good day.
You're listening to 90 Days Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.